Texas has a reputation for being tough on crime, but beneath the surface, in the darkness, is an incredible number of mysteries left undone.
There are monsters among us.
There are approximately 20,000 unsolved homicides throughout the Lone Star State, cases that have gone cold, waiting for new information or evidence. On Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, we tell in-depth stories of these unsolved murders and missing persons cases, from the historic and mysterious 1948 disappearance of Denton co-ed Virginia Carpenter, to the unspeakably brutal 2014 slaying of Delisa Kelly in Dallas.
This was personal. It was personal.
Join us weekly as we attempt to keep these terrible and tragic stories alive in hopes the victims' loved ones can one day see justice. You can subscribe to Gone Cold, Texas True Crime, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Some people end up being cheerleaders and hang around in that circle. I ended up on the opposite end of the totem pole. I wasn't born a bad person, and I don't have to always be a bad person. I mean, people can change. I mean, even if you don't use any other excuse, and I do take full blame, but you can't. No one can be in their right mind that does something like that. That's sick. I just want to be able to share the life in me with others. Instead of taking lives, I just want to save lives, and I can't do that.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. Today's episode is going to be a long one. It involves sex, drugs, rock and roll, a pickaxe, converting to Christianity, doing television interviews, and having a lot of the nation fall in love with a killer. It's a rocky ride, everyone. Let's get started. Houston, Texas, November 18, 1959. Carla Faye Tucker was born. Her parents were Larry, who worked on the Gulf of Mexico as a longshoreman, and Carolyn. They had a marriage that was stressful, difficult, and unraveling at the seams. By the time Carla was 8 years old, she was smoking with her sisters. Carla was the youngest of the three. Larry and Carolyn decided to get a divorce when Carla was 10. In court, we can only imagine Carla's feelings of confusion, sadness, and pain when she found out Larry was not her biological father. Carolyn had an affair, and Carla was conceived during that time. Things started to get bad for young Carla when she turned to drugs and sex at only 12 years old. By the time she was 14, Carla quit going to school. Instead, she was going along with her mother, who was a groupie of rock bands. Carla and her mother were now sex workers and went around the country with the Allman Brothers Band, the Marshall Tucker Band, and the Eagles. Carolyn and her 14-year-old daughter were out partying and having sex all the time without a care in the world. A mechanic by the name of Stephen Griffith came into Carla's life, and at 16 years old, Carla and Stephen got hitched, but their marriage didn't last very long. Carla's mother, Carolyn, died in 1979 on Christmas Eve from the effects of abusing drugs. After her mother died, who she said was the only person who really ever loved her, she started getting mixed up with wild crowds. Carla was living it up and really enjoying her early 20s in the early 1980s. She was making friends with bikers and hung out with them frequently. Carla became good friends with Sean Dean, who was the wife of one of the bikers, Jerry Lynn Dean. In 1981, Carla's friend Sean knew just the guy that Carla needed to meet, named Danny Garrett. Carla and Danny hit it off and became a couple. In 1983, the lovebirds spent the weekend drugging and letting their hair down with their friends. Monday, June 14th, 1983. It was about 3 in the morning when Carla, Danny, and one of their pals, James, snuck into the apartment of Jerry Dean. They were going to steal the keys to his motorcycle and go back out and take it. That's all it was supposed to be. Still a crime, but Carla was pissed off about something which will come to light later. James said he was searching for Jerry Dean's El Camino while Carla and Danny were in Jerry's apartment. They snuck in with a key that Carla said her so-called friend, Sean, had lost, and she had found it. What was supposedly meant to be a robbery turned into murder awfully fast due to Carla's anger that she had towards Jerry. She explains her reasoning and anger later. Carla and Danny crept into Jerry Dean's bedroom. Carla proceeded to sit on Jerry, putting his own pickaxe to his head, and said, "Don't move, motherfucker, or you're dead." Jerry begged for his life, and he grabbed Carla's arms right above her elbows to try and restrain her. Danny picked up a hammer that he spotted on the floor and began beating Jerry in the back of the head over and over again. After this, Carla's beau walked out of the bedroom and collected a bunch of motorcycle parts and left the apartment. However, Carla decided to stay in the bedroom with Jerry, who had been hit so hard so many times with the hammer that his head had become unattached from his neck. He was making gurgling noises due to fluid consuming his breathing passages. Carla, quote, wanted to stop him from making that noise. She grabbed the pickaxe and started to viciously attack him. Her boyfriend Danny came back into the apartment and into the bedroom, and he gave the final hit to Jerry in the chest. Danny vacated the bedroom yet again, leaving Carla in there alone, so they thought. As Danny was putting all of the motorcycle parts into his ranchero, something caught Carla's eyes. There was something against the wall, a lump of bed covers. This something turned out to be a someone. It was Deborah Thornton, doing her best to hide. Deborah and Jerry had only just met earlier at a party. Now she was in fear for her life. Carla strolled over to Deborah, teasing her sinisterly by grazing her shoulder with the pickaxe. The two women got into a bit of a tussle, and suddenly Danny stormed back into the bedroom and broke up the two. Carla showed this woman no mercy. She began stabbing her numerous times with the pickaxe and then lodged it into Deborah's heart. Carla said she had multiple extreme orgasms with each stab of the pickaxe. She and Danny had also spent the last few days on meth, heroin, Dilaudid, Valium, Somas, marijuana, rum, tequila, and a few other hard drugs. June 13th, 1983, Jerry's co-worker, Gregory Traver, showed up to the complex the next morning. He was going to hitch a ride with Jerry to work. He waited a while and went to check to see what was going on. Gregory knocked on the door, and it was slightly open, so he called out to Jerry, but there was no response. He slowly went inside and found Jerry in the spare bedroom, laid out on the floor with blood on his head. Deborah, who he did not know, was lying beside him with a pickaxe embedded in her chest. He called authorities immediately. Gregory was in the apartment and knew Jerry had been building a motorcycle, but everything was gone. The parts, the motorcycle, and Jerry's El Camino. Police finally arrived and saw Jerry and Deborah on the bed and floor of the bedroom. There were many boxes of items piled up in the room, as well as stacks of dirty clothes and garden tools. Jerry and Deborah had been stabbed to the point of overkill with the pickaxe in Deborah's chest. Not only did the culprits who killed these two run off with the motorcycle, motorcycle parts, and Jerry's El Camino, but they also stole both Jerry and Deborah's wallets. 5 weeks went by until they had a solid lead during the investigation. Doug Garrett, the brother of Danny, and his girlfriend Carrie, which is Carla's sister, told the homicide detective J.C. Mosier, who was a longtime friend of Doug's, that Danny and Carla had been the ones who killed Jerry and Deborah. Danny's brother also told the detective that their friend Jason was also there while it took place. After talking to the officers investigating the murders, Doug agreed to have himself wired with a microphone in order to get information straight from Carla and Danny's mouths. A couple of days later, Doug rode his motorcycle over to Danny and Carla's house. Doug, Carla, and his brother Danny spoke for about 1.5 hours about the murders. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is something preventing you from achieving your goals? Is something getting in the way of your happiness? Check out BetterHelp.com/listener. As a listener, you'll get 10% off of your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/listener. So, what is BetterHelp? It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. BetterHelp assesses your needs and they match you with your own licensed professional therapist. It's super convenient. You don't have to go to therapy in person. You don't even have to be on camera if you don't want to. And if you're not really vibing with the therapist that you get, you can always find another one. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. You can also send a message to your counselor at any time, and you'll get a timely and thoughtful response. You can also schedule weekly video or phone sessions. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. Find the particular expertise you need online and don't limit yourself to the counselors located near you. There are licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma. Anything that you share is confidential. I want you to start living a happier life today. So again, as a listener, you'll get 10% off of your first month by going to betterhelp.com/listener. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/listener. The conversation was recorded and the tape was admitted into evidence at Carla's trial. The same day after Doug got the audio evidence that police needed, Carla, Danny, Carrie's ex-husband Ronnie, and James were all arrested. According to court records, the following story was told during the guilt/innocence phase of Carla's trial. A lot of Carrie's quotes are from what she heard from Danny and Carla, and they're not accurate to the crime scene, as you'll notice. On June 12, 1983, Carla, her boyfriend Danny, Carrie's ex-husband Ronnie, and their friend James were at Carla's house. For the most of the afternoon, they had been drinking, smoking pot, and eating pills. That evening, Carrie and Ronnie left the house separately and did not return until the next day. Between 2:30 and 4:30 on the morning of June 13, 1983, Carla, Danny, and Jason decided to go over to Jerry Lynn Dean's apartment to, quote, intimidate him, collect some money Jerry allegedly owed Carla or Danny, and to steal his motorcycle. Danny took his shotgun along just in case Jerry resisted. There was also some testimony that Danny took some rubber gloves along, though it's not clear whether he actually wore them during the killings. Carla had been talking about offing Jerry Dean and taking his motorcycle for quite some time. Upon arriving at Jerry's apartment, Carla and Danny walked to the front door, while Jason remained outside. Carla unlocked the door with a key she had stolen from her friend Sean, who was Jerry's estranged wife. They proceeded to Jerry's bedroom, where Jerry Dean and Deborah Thornton were sleeping. According to Carrie, Carla, quote, put a pickaxe up to Jerry Dean's head and told him not to move, motherfucker, or you're dead, end quote. Carla told her sister that she or Danny, quote, bunted one of them upside the head, I don't know which one, end quote. And when Jerry began to beg for his life, Carla picked him numerous times. She also told Carrie, quote, every time she picked Jerry, that she looked up and she grinned and got a nut and hit him again, end quote. After Carla and Danny had disposed of Jerry, Carla discovered Deborah Thornton in the room, shaking in terror. Quote, they pushed the girl down, threw her under the sheets, and told her if she wanted to live to see the daylight, to be quiet and stay underneath the sheets, end quote. Carla and Danny then began to pick Deborah, and when she begged for them to go ahead and kill her because she couldn't take any more, then, quote, Danny kicked her upside the chin and through her back and buried the axe into her throat, the pickaxe, end quote. At some point during the killings, Danny went outside to get Jason, who had been napping in Danny's Ranchero pickup. When Jason entered the apartment, he heard a gurgling noise that, quote, sounded like an aquarium pump that was broken, end quote. Jason then observed Carla standing with one foot on a body, which was covered with a sheet, jerking on the pickaxe, trying to get it loose. She finally got the axe out, got it up over her head, turned and looked at me and smiled and hit the dude again, end quote. Stunned by this sight, Jason fled the apartment. Jerry died of severe trauma to the head and multiple stab wounds. After the killing of Jerry and Deborah, Carla and Danny placed Jerry's partially assembled motorcycle in the back of the dead man's El Camino pickup, along with some boxes of motorcycle parts that they had found in the apartment. Carla drove the El Camino over to Doug's apartment. There, she related the events of the morning to Doug, describing how she and Danny had, quote, offed Jerry Dean last night. Dan hit him with a hammer and I picked him. And Doug, I came with every stroke of the pickaxe, end quote. She handed Danny's brother Doug Jerry's wallet, which he threw in the trash after burning its contents. The El Camino was abandoned that same day in a parking lot near the Astrodome. The motorcycle and its parts were stored for a while in Doug's garage, then in Danny's before Doug decided to throw them into the Brazos River. Back at the house she shared with Danny and Carrie, Carla told her sister how she and Danny had killed Jerry and Deborah and that she got a thrill while picking Jerry. Carla gave Deborah's wallet to her sister Carrie as a birthday present, which Carrie threw away in disgust. Later that day, a story about the killings was broadcasted on the local news. Carla and Danny laughed and bragged that they were the pickaxe murderers. Carrie became frightened for her life, and that very day she moved out of the house and in with Danny's brother Doug, whom she later married. The testimony that was given at the punishment phase of Carla's trial showed she had a history of violent behavior, even though she did not have prior convictions. The psychological and psychiatric testimony, though somewhat conflicting, also showed her violent nature. Carla herself took the stand and testified to her turbulent past. At age 14, she beat up a classmate, blackening both her eyes. She got in a fight with a man and a woman when she was 15, and regularly fought with her ex-husband, Stephen. In all, she claims to have been in, quote, at least three good fights that someone was hurt, end quote. Carla also stated that she had disliked Jerry and told how she had once attacked him, breaking his glasses and requiring him to go to the hospital to have the glass removed from his eye. After the killings of Jerry and Deborah, Carla bragged to the others about what she had done and boasted about her sexual gratification every time she struck Jerry with the pickaxe. Carla showed no remorse until after she was arrested. Carla's sister Carrie stated that she had heard her sister and Danny talking about killing Jason and her ex-husband Ronnie to keep them from talking to anyone about the murders. Carla did verify this conversation during the punishment phase. She also testified about her plans to go on future criminal adventures with Danny and his friends to raid drug labs, kill the people who worked there, and to steal their property. All of her testimony pointed to her violent past and how she would be willing to continue to do this type of behavior. Not long after being locked up, Carla grabbed a Bible from the ministry program in the prison. Later, she said, quote, I didn't know what I was reading. Before I knew it, I was in the middle of my cell floor on my knees. I was just asking God to forgive me, end quote. In October of 1983, Carla proclaimed that she was a Christian, as many prisoners do or possibly pretend to. She and her prison minister, Reverend Dana Lane Brown, eventually married at the prison. Carla talked about the motive behind stabbing and hacking away at 27-year-old Jerry Dean with a pickaxe over 20 times. Carla said she had a score to settle. She was holding a grudge against Jerry because he brought his motorcycle inside of her house and oil leaked all over her precious floor, and somehow Jerry ruined the only photograph she had of herself with her mother. 32-year-old Deborah Thornton was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. That night, she and her husband Richard had gotten into an argument, and she left the house angry. She went to a party and went home with Jerry. Deborah had also been plunged with the pickaxe around 20 times before it was lodged into her heart. Now, females that were on trial rarely ever received a death sentence, but Carla and Danny Garrett were shown no mercy, just like their victims, and were both given the death sentence in 1984. 9 years later, 1993, Danny passed away in prison of liver disease as he was waiting for a retrial when it came to the murder of Jerry Dean. Carla and Pam Perillo became great friends. They both shared a death row cell at the Mountain View unit. However, her good friend Pam would get out of death row later, and her sentence was changed to life imprisonment. Of course, Carla had appeals and requests for retrials, but they were denied from 1984 to 1992. However, on June 22, 1992, Carla begged for her life to be saved since she said she was taking drugs when the murders were committed. She said she would never have done anything like that had she not been on drugs, and she was a changed person and devoted Christian. She actually received support from many leaders of American conservatism. There were so many who, on Carla's behalf, appealed to the state of Texas. Just to name a few, there was the World Council of Churches, Pope John Paul II, Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi, Newt Gingrich, who was the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Pat Robertson, a televangelist, and Ron Carlson, Deborah Thornton's brother. Even Texas's Huntsville warden of the prison said under oath that Carla was a model prisoner and more than likely had now been a rehabilitated woman after being on death row for 14 years. On January 28, 1998, the board disagreed and turned Carla down. On February 2, 1998, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice put her on one of their airplanes and transferred her from the Gatesville unit to the Huntsville unit. Carla did many interviews and really enchanted and won over a lot of people. However, some people said that her twinkling eyes and angelic smile did not fool them at all and could never erase the horrific crime she and Danny committed. But a lot of people, including televangelist Pat Robertson, said Carla was a sweet woman of God. People were treating her differently because she was a woman, and it didn't hurt that she had what I would call, by society standards, a pretty face. A lot of people called this behavior out. There had been plenty of men who found God in prison, but they didn't get the same reaction of sympathy as Carla Faye, who was plastered all over TV doing interviews. The same woman who her ex-husband Stephen Griffith told the Houston Chronicle that she always said she wanted to be famous. But she stole the hearts of many, partly because of her small voice and innocent looks. In one article, she was called the nicest woman on death row, stating it's hard to believe such an attractive, sweet-natured, born-again Christian could commit such gruesome crimes. I'm going to put a few interviews in at the end of the episode, but I'm going to start with Deborah's brother, Ron Carlson's interview/documentary, which is 30 minutes long, but it is very interesting, and I'll put Carla's at the end. Her reverend husband also speaks, and I will let you know right before that one happens, so you can recognize his voice. A majority of the 18 parole board members told the Chronicle that Carla Faye Tucker was going to have a real hard time trying to convince them that she should not be put to death. Finding God did not seem to be changing any minds on the parole board. Victor Rodriguez, the board chairman, said, quote, "Religious conversion is not a factor in anything we do. I do not expect it to be a factor in this case either," end quote. Carla wrote, at the time, Governor George W. Bush and the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles to plead her case. I'm going to read to you parts of that letter that were in the Houston Chronicle. Carla wrote, quote, "I am in no way attempting to minimize the brutality of my crime. It obviously was very, very horrible, and I do take full responsibility for what happened. I also know that justice and law demand my life for the two innocent lives I brutally murdered that night. If my execution is the only thing, the final act that can fulfill the demand for restitution and justice, then I accept that. I will pay the price for what I did in any way our law demands it. I was advised by my attorneys to plead not guilty, and I was trusting their legal expertise. They knew I murdered Jerry and Deborah. I did not lie to them about it. I am, in fact, guilty, very guilty. I used to try and blame my mother because she was my role model, and she fashioned and shaped me into what I was at an early age. At 14, she took me to a place where there was all men and wanted to, quote, school me in the art of being a call girl. I wanted to please my mother so much. I wanted her to be proud of me. So instead of saying no, I just tried to do what she asked. The thing is, deep down inside, I knew that what I was doing was wrong. It may have been the norm for the crowd I was in, but it was not the norm for decent, upstanding families. I no longer try to lay the blame on my mother or on society. I don't blame drugs either. When I share that I was out of it on drugs the night I brutally murdered two people, I fully realize that I made the choice to do those drugs. Had I chosen not to do drugs, there would be two people still alive today. But I did choose to do drugs, and I did lose it, and two people are dead because of me. I did not plan on going over there that particular night to go into that apartment to kill anyone. But that is beside the point. The fact is, we went in there, we went into that apartment, we brutally murdered two precious people, and we left out of there and even bragged about what we did for over a month afterward. It was in October, 3 months after I had been locked up, when a ministry came to the jail and I went to the services. That night, accepting Jesus into my heart. When I did this, the full and overwhelming weight and reality of what I had done hit me. I began crying that night for the first time in many years, and to this day, tears are a part of my life. I also wanted to try and send some money out to one of my victim's family members. It was for Deborah's son for his schooling. When Ron Carlson came to me in 1992 and told me he had forgiven me for what I had done to his sister, I let him know I was trying to get some money to his nephew. He told me not to. I would only be hurting him if I did send the money to him, and he told me that his nephew would not receive the money from me anyway because he wanted nothing to do with me. I understand the pain, and I did not push. 14 years ago, I was part of the problem. Now I am part of the solution. I have purposely done right for the last 14 years, not because I am in prison, but because my God demands this of me. I know right from wrong, and I must do right. I feel that if I were in here, still in the frame of mind I got arrested in, still acting out and fighting and hurting others and not caring or trying to do good, I feel sure you would consider that against me. I don't really understand why you can't or won't consider my change for the good in my favor. I don't really understand the guidelines for commutation of death sentences, but I can promise you this: if you commute my sentence to life, I will continue for the rest of my life in this earth to reach out to others to make a positive difference in their lives. I see people in here in the prison where I am who are here for horrible crimes and for lesser crimes, who to this day are still acting out in violence and hurting others with no concern for another life or for their own life. I can reach out to these girls and try to help and change them before they walk out of this place and hurt someone else. I am seeking you to commute my sentence and allow me to pay society back by helping others. I can't bring back the lives I took, but I can, if I am allowed, help to save lives. That is the only real restitution I can give. End quote. Her plea was rejected, and then Governor George W. Bush made this public statement. Quote, "When I was sworn in as the governor of Texas, I took an oath of office to uphold the laws of our state, including the death penalty. My responsibility is to ensure our laws are enforced fairly and evenly without preference or special treatment. Many people have contacted my office about this execution. I respect the strong convictions which have prompted some to call for mercy and others to emphasize accountability and consequences. Like many touched by this case, I have sought guidance through prayer. I have concluded judgment about the heart and soul of an individual on death row are best left to a higher authority. Carla Faye Tucker has acknowledged she is guilty of a horrible crime. She was convicted and sentenced by a jury of her peers. The role of the state is to enforce our laws and to make sure all individuals are treated fairly under those laws. The state must make sure each individual sentenced to death has opportunity for access to the court and a thorough legal review. The courts, including the United States Supreme Court, have reviewed the legal issues in this case, and therefore I will not grant a 30-day stay. May God bless Carla Faye Tucker, and may God bless her victims and their families." End quote. Carla was able to pick 5 people to watch her get executed. She chose Deborah's husband, Richard, his daughter, Catherine Thornton, and William Joseph Davis, Deborah's son from a marriage prior, and they all wanted Carla to die. She also chose Ron Carlson, Deborah's brother, who had been completely against her execution as mentioned before, and after visiting Carla on death row, he also became a Christian. Jerry Dean's family did not contact state prison officials to be at the execution. Carla Faye Tucker's last meal was a peach, banana, and a garden salad with ranch dressing. Carla's last words before her lethal injection were, quote, "Yes, sir, I would like to say to all of you, the Thornton family and Jerry Dean's family, that I am sorry. I hope God will give you peace with this." She looked over to her husband and said, "Baby, I love you." Carla, looking at Ron Carlson, said, quote, "Ron, give Peggy a hug for me." She then looked at everyone as some cried and some were happy and ready for her to go, saying, quote, "Everybody has been so good to me. I love all of you very much. I am going to be face to face with Jesus now. Warden Baggett, thank all of you so much. You have been so good to me. I love all of you very much. I will see you all when you get there, and I will wait for you." End quote. 200 or more reporters were surrounding the state prison system's walls unit. It was total media chaos. As she was being lethally injected, she was praising Jesus as her sister Carrie yelled out, "I love you, Carla." And Deborah's husband Richard, who was in a wheelchair, staring at Carla at eye level, said, quote, "Here she comes, baby doll. She's all yours. The world's a better place." End quote. And 8 minutes after the injection, she was pronounced deceased at 6:45 p.m. Central Time. Carla Faye Tucker, at 38 years old, was the only woman that had been executed in Texas since 1863. That's 135 years prior. Richard Thornton, Deborah's husband, on the day of the execution said, quote, "Make no mistake, this is not Carla Faye Tucker's day. This is Deborah Ruth Davis Thornton's day," end quote. Of Carla's husband, Dana, Richard said, quote, "So now Dana Brown gets to write his book," end quote. After Carla's death, Dana said, quote, "Her gain today was our loss. Someone that literally reached thousands of people for Jesus Christ and probably will continue through her testimony. Even though she cried out for forgiveness, God gave her just what she needed. That was love. We've all made mistakes in our lives. Who are we to say when a person is past redemption? And that's what we're saying when we kill people, human beings," end quote. Carla was buried at Forest Park, Lawndale Cemetery in Houston. I wanted to include some interviews I found as a little bonus for the end of this episode, just in case you all wanted to listen. This first interview / 30-minute kind of documentary is mostly of Deborah Thornton's brother Ron talking about his and Deborah's life, what they went through, how he felt when he heard that his sister was murdered, and what led him to change how he felt about the death sentence and Carla Tucker.
Carla Faye Tucker. Here, still before her execution, in the prison where she remained for 14 years, before finally being given the fatal injection on the 3rd of February, 1998. On the 13th of July, 1983, while she was heavily under the influence of drugs, she and her friend Danny Garrett brutally murdered Jerry Dean and Deborah Thornton. Ron, Deborah's brother, who was very close to her, heard by telephone about the horrible death of his sister.
I come in from my job at 5 o'clock in the evening after a hard day's work, and I get in and my phone rings, and the first thing I know, guy's on the phone saying, my dad's on the phone saying, "Hey, you need to come over to the shop." I'm like, "What's up?" He says, "Your sister's been murdered." I'm like, "No, Sure enough, she was. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe they'd kill my sister. Now, I really couldn't believe it when I saw the pictures on the TV. I mean, it's a situation where When you're looking on your TV and you see the bodies of two people being loaded into an ambulance, you just can't believe that those things would happen. My sister raised me. My mother died when I was 5 years old. My sister raised me. I had no brothers. I had one sister. And my sister was murdered. She was very special. Very special. I mean, she made sure that I had clothes to wear. She made sure there was food on the table. She slapped my hand if I did something wrong. She made me do my homework. She helped me. She taught me. Just like my mom. Made me sick to know what they did to my sister, the way they left that pickaxe left in her heart. The bodies were mutilated. The bodies suffered over 25 or 30 puncture wounds on each body. It was a situation where my sister was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Prosecutor Joe Magliola called it a horrendous crime. In closing arguments, Tucker had ordered Thornton to put a blanket over her head while she repeatedly struck Dean with a pickaxe that the cable TV technician just happened to have lying beside his bed.
They came over here to steal motorcycle parts. They found Jerry at home, and they decided to kill Jerry. when they did, they also discovered my sister. And they had to kill her too to keep from having a witness. This is when my mother was still alive. I was about 3 years old then. This is Debbie, and this is myself. And then this picture here was taken, in the back of my grandmother's house. This is Debbie here. This is myself. And Debbie wanted to find my natural father because we were both being raised by a man that adopted us because my mother divorced my natural father when I was like... a year, 2 years old, something like that. So she chose to leave home, and she came to Texas to find her natural father. She knew that he was in Texas.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
When I became 15, which was 3 years after she left, I chose to leave home. I wanted to find where my sister was, and I also wanted to find my natural father. When I finally got down here, I started doing drugs. I got involved in drinking, smoking marijuana, taking LSD, all kinds of different drugs. Whatever I could get my hands on, I would take. Anyway, to make a long story short, they found the body of my sister in an apartment. She had a 3-foot pickaxe left buried in her heart, and they didn't know who did it. I think it was like 2 or 3 weeks later that they finally figured out who did it. Carla's sister and her brother was afraid that they were going to be killed next because they knew what had happened. And they told him that they knew who the pickaxe murderers were. They were guilty. They admitted it.
Prosecutor Joe Magliola said Arnold was brilliant to admit his client's guilt. He looks to a tough battle getting the death penalty.
She is young. She's female. She's a person who ordinarily capital cases are not even sought against, or capital punishment is not sought against.
Well, my feelings towards Carl and Danny was sheer hatred. I wanted to kill them myself. I wanted to take that same pickaxe and leave it buried in my in Carla's chest, just like it was left in my sister's chest. I don't think it's right to kill, but I couldn't deal with it, and I wanted to get even. I just wanted to kill him.
While Ron was unable to cope with his grief and rage on account of the murder of his sister Debbie, something took place in the prison in which Carla was held, which would have a big effect on her life.
The first time I met Carla was when she was in the county jail in Houston. And we were ministering with a puppet show, which we found to be very effective because the women would come and not feel like they were being preached at, you know, and they could have fun and laugh, kind of forget they were in jail for a little while. And so all the women were coming out of the tank, and so she didn't want to be left behind, even though she didn't go to church, you know, even there. But she thought, well, okay, let's go. I'll be with the group, you know, and just have fun.
When I was in jail, I remember when we learned how to make makeup out of toothpaste. We made out of toothpaste on those magazines. Can they color? Oh, we had all that. We were going to look nice no matter what. But anyway. In 77, I was facing 5 years up to life for sales of heroin. Was a junkie, a topless dancer, just miserable, you know, and had been shooting drugs since I was 12. You know, and
when I shared my testimony at that time, that I started shooting drugs when I was 12,
in Houston. Well, she was from Houston. She had started shooting drugs when she was 10. I mean, you just can't hardly imagine, you know, her life that she lived. You know, her mother was a prostitute and drug her around, introduced her to drug and prostitution. And, you know, of course, she never saw any hope in that. But when she heard a testimony that somebody was really real and changed, you know, she was like, oh, man, you know, can this happen for me? And it did. It happened for her. She came up to me at the end of the service, and this is the only time I've ever seen her with that emptiness, you know, just pale, so pale, and just no life in her. And, you know, she asked me, well, you know, you really did that? You started shooting when you were that young? And she told me I started when I was 10. And, you know, she just thought, man, it really made her start thinking. And then she took a Bible. In fact, she thought she was stealing one because she didn't know they were free. But she took one anyway. That's the important thing. And she went back to her cell and began to read. And just the Spirit of the Lord touched her. And she cried out to God that night in her cell. You know, she gave her life to him, and he saved her just like he saved me and all the other Christians I know.
You know. Since 1983, when I gave my life to the Lord, it's not been in vain because I've had an abundant life in my heart because of that. I've been able to, instead of hurt people now, I'm able to help people. I've experienced true love. I know how to love people now, and people love me for who I am now. It's been pretty wonderful. That sounds strange for in prison, not because I'm in prison, or not because the food's good or anything like that, but because Christ is in my heart. I've learned a whole new way of life, and so every day is special. Every day is a blessing. And my life hasn't been in vain in the last 14 and a half years.
Carla found a new life within the prison walls. But outside, the opposite happened to Ron. He still hadn't come to terms with the loss of his sister Debbie when there occurred yet another dramatic event within his family. His despair and rage grew even greater.
So life goes on. We bury my sister. I go back home. I'm getting involved more heavily into the drugs. I'm relying more on the alcohol. I've lost my family. 1 year later, my father, my natural father, Bill, the man that called me and told me my sister had been murdered, he's shot to death.
In about 1980, I had a patient named Deborah Davis, who later became Deborah Thornton. She referred her father to me as a patient. And he was 6'2", 400 pounds. And he came to me for back pain. But I found out that he drank a bottle of whiskey a day, smoked a carton of cigarettes every 2 days. He drank 15 cups of coffee a day. He took 100 antacids for digestive problems a day. He had an ulcer, high blood pressure, highly congested lungs. You could hear him breathing from far away. I told him, I said, Bill, you have a lot of problems that any one of them could cripple or kill you. And he said, I know. He said, the medical doctors have given up on me. They said I have about 2 years left to live. He said, if you think you can help me, I'm listening. Bill did everything I asked him to do. He got his health back. And he went on to build the largest house in Texas, 34,000 square feet. And at the open house, I bought a Bible, New International Version, large print. And I wrote in the Bible in the front, happy birthday, congratulations on the new house, and signed my name. And I had moved to this area of town, so I put in my new phone number. Well, 6 weeks later, I saw on the news that he had been murdered, and they showed the house and I met the teenager that murdered him at that open house. He was a male prostitute. I had given a Bible to Bill, hoping that here's a man that would listen to me and did everything I said. So maybe he would listen to that and would develop a spiritual life. Well, I thought that was end of story.
About a year after that, something extraordinary happened in my life. My drug dealer, of all things, the guy that sells me the drugs, brings me this Bible. And he says, here, you should have this. And I'm like, what is this? He says, this is something that belonged to your dad. I found it in his house. I'm like, okay. And I look it up, look inside, and sure enough, it says, to William Gerald List, which was my natural father's name, and it has a date in it, and it says inside of it, it says it's given by a Dr. Steve Harris, and I didn't know who a Dr. Steve Harris was, and I'm like, this is weird. So I do my usual routine. I sit down, I roll me another joint, I'm starting to get high, and I start reading the Word of God. Now this is weird. You know, here you are, drug addict, boozer. Your whole family's dead, and what are you doing? You're sitting there smoking doobies, reading the Word of God. Well, I'm cruising along, going through the Bible, and I get to the part where they killed Jesus, where Jesus Christ is crucified. When I read how they hung Jesus on a cross and crucified him, that's when I slammed the book closed, and I said, my God, they even killed God. And I've never done this before in my life, but I got down on my knees, and I closed my eyes, and I folded my hands together like this, and I just said, Lord, Lord Jesus, I just want you to come into my life. And Lord Jesus, I just want you to be my Lord and Savior and just make me the kind of believer that you want me to be. That was basically... That was basically what I prayed that night, was that he would just make me the type of believer that he wanted me to be.
I came to a point in my life where I knew that I had to do something with the hatred and the anger that was within me. It was consuming me. All I wanted to do was to destroy things and kill people. I was being just as bad as the ones that destroyed my family. Well, there's a scripture in the Bible that talks about forgiveness, and it's in the Lord's Prayer. In the Lord's Prayer, it says, we will be forgiven as we forgave. And that one little statement right there taught me a valuable lesson that if I want to be forgiven, I've got to learn how to forgive. Well, when I learned that, I cried out to the Lord. I said, Lord, I can't do this. And he says, well, Ron, you're right. You can't. But through me, you can.
I was talking to a friend of mine on the phone one night, and I was been talking to him a lot about Carla Faye Tucker, and he said, well, you know she's in town, don't you? And I said, yeah, I know that. And he says, well, you ought to go down there and just give her a piece of your mind. Of course, he didn't know where I was at and what I was thinking. And I told him, I said, well, I've been thinking about doing something just like that. And I slammed the phone down. I go up to the 12th floor of the Harris County Jail. I fill out a slip. I stand there and I wait. The next thing I know, here comes Carla Faye Tucker walking up to this glass. And I walk up to her, and she looks at me, and she says, who are you? And I look at her, and all I say is, I'm the brother of Deborah. She looks at me again, but then it's like, who are you? You know, she knows who I am, but she can't believe what's going on. And I tell her the same thing, I'm the brother of Deborah. At that point, she starts to cry. In the middle of all of that, I'm interrupting her, saying, Carla, whatever comes out of all of this, I just want you to know that I forgive you and I don't hold anything against you. Then it was about that time that
The guards, they thought I was, you know, causing a problem. They were fixing to come pull me out of there, and they were fixing to come pull her out. Well, she was waving them off, telling them, no, no, leave us alone, everything's fine. It was at that point when I told her, I forgive you, and I don't hold anything against you. That's when that hatred and that anger was taken away. It was like a great weight was lifted off of my shoulders.
It's unbelievable that he could forgive you for killing his sister.
It's definitely...
It affected me.
It's amazing, you know, and if people never believe me, they can't possibly look at Peggy and Ron and not believe that, you know, not believe God in them, because they couldn't do it any other way. So
I love you. I need you. Well, my world may fall, I'm never ashamed. My Savior, my closest friend.
Yeah, after my first visit, I wanted to know more about her. I wanted to try to understand why men and women murder. And I also wanted to really find out, was this person sincere in this so-called Christian walk that they supposedly had? Well, basically I found out that this person was real, a real Christian. Other than that, I haven't learned anything other than God is real and that He can change lives. I still haven't figured out why people kill one another, other than it's just they don't care or they don't give a damn or whatever. I don't know. I can't explain why people kill. But I did learn out of the whole thing that people can change and that God is definitely real and alive. And he's working inside those prison walls. He really is.
There are 214 women on the camp, and about nearly half of them participate in church, you know, Christians, in the Bible studies and the different things that we have here. I really appreciate the people coming in to share with us, to show their love. And people on the outside, they forget about us on the inside. And on the inside, we have just as much love, the love of God in our hearts, as the ones on the outside. It gives you a sense of peace and a sense of freedom, because that's what it takes to live here, because you're around all different peoples from all walks of life, and people that aren't Christians, and they're still evil and in here. And so you just have to pray and keep on the full arm of God, and just, it's a daily walk. Every day you have to walk close with Him every day.
I came up for 2 years about every other month, and I was writing letters all the time, always writing letters, and I'd visit when I could. And the ones that didn't agree with it, of course, they thought I was wrong. They told me that I should have vengeance and that I should hate the person that killed my family. And I even had one relative tell me that I was disgracing my sister's grave by doing what I did, and that my sister was rolling over in her grave.
The Houston Chronicle headline says, if she's found God, good for her. However, it's not an issue in applying a sentence the jury gave to her.
Well, I think it does apply, because one of your issues when you're sentencing someone to death is, will they be a continuing threat to society? I remember during the trial, my prosecutor told the jury that any act of violence, whether it was a slap on the face to somebody, would be a continuing threat to society. In 14 and a half years, I have not had any kind of any kind of encounters like that whatsoever, then I think for me and for others who are in this situation, I think that should be considered, yes. I mean, not just for me. Please, please understand what I'm saying here. What I'm saying is that when people share about being changed and it's sincere and it can be proven, that should be considered in a life in here.
Today is a day that I've called it Deborah Thornton Day. This is a day when my wife is center stage. Carla Faye Tucker will die today. My family and I will be very happy about that incident.
The blood that Jesus shed on that cross for me took the death penalty from me. And the world may not understand that. They may not agree with it. They may not think I deserve that. But who does deserve forgiveness?
Carla Faye Tucker, the last time you saw a member of my family, you killed him. Next time you see a member of my family, we have a saying in Texas, what comes around, goes around. We live by it.
That's his pain, and I don't know if there would ever be anything I could do to help him. The Lord could help him, and if I am executed, I would pray that would give him some peace.
If every one of you were to get the transcripts of that 1984 trial and compare it to what Carla Faye Tucker says today, you'd have no problem understanding that this woman is lying.
He's the one that has to live with the pain of what happened, of what I inflicted upon him through this. So I understand. I understand that kind of pain and anger and bitterness. Who wouldn't? Who wouldn't? I mean, anyway.
At the Walls unit where they execute the people, they have three rooms. One is a square area, and they have a table or a gurney, and they strap the inmate down to the gurney, and they have IVs in their arms. And in one room, the victim's family is in. In the other room, inmate's family and friends are in. I went in the inmate's family and friends room because I was there as a friend.
Forgiveness was one thing. But to go so far beyond that, actively, to come up and to love me, to actively love me and to be friends with me.
Are you fighting to live?
No, because the reality is that death has no sting on those who know the Lord. So my fight is for the cause of Christ and for sharing that. The life that I've been given, the hope, the promise, the reality that this is not it. This is not the final thing here.
Faye Tucker pronounced dead at 6:45. That was about 8 minutes after the lethal injection was administered. Carla Faye Tucker, at the age of 38, has now been put to death.
The whole time throughout the execution, Carla was smiling, as I said, and she hummed.
It did no good whatsoever to kill Carla. It does no good whatsoever to execute any of them. It doesn't make our streets safer, but it does add more victims in our society.
Her killer has been sent to the place we're all going to go sometime. Someplace my wife already is there. She will deal with Carla Faye Tucker.
Get her down.
I promise you, it won't be pretty.
When I heard that, I was like, come on, Richard. Heaven's not that way. It's not where you continue the fights. It's all over. Once you check out of here, that's it. It's over with.
I'd like to read the whole statement to you so that you can know exactly what she said. She said, "Yes, sir. I would like to say to all of you, the Thornton family and Jerry Dean's family, that I am so sorry. I hope God will give you peace with this. Ron, give Peggy a hug for me. Everybody has been so good to me.
I miss them. I miss them both. I miss my sister because of what she taught me, and I miss Carla because she helped me with my walk with Jesus. Carla was an inspiration to my faith."
"You think they can get along?"
"Yeah. Yeah. I have no doubt about it."
The next interviews are of Carla talking a lot about her faith.
"Carla, one of the areas you've really had to deal with is forgiveness. You've had to extend it, and you've had to receive it. But there's a great freedom that comes with that. So mm-hmm. many of us who aren't behind these bars and walls and plexiglass and wire are trapped in unforgiveness. What's God taught you about forgiveness?"
"That, as you said, there's a freedom in it. When I was forgiven and I experienced that forgiveness, it freed me up inside to soar. You know, it freed me up inside to go higher and to go deeper with the Lord. But when we're holding unforgiveness, we're blocking communication and intimacy with the Lord in our own lives, and bitterness can start to take root in us. Well, when God forgave me, I think he used that forgiveness and that love to reach down inside of me and take every root of evil, every root of horror that was in me, and literally pull it up and get rid of it and go back in me and fill up with his love."
"Carla, sometimes when people come through experiences like you did as a child, you can feel so trapped. You can feel like nobody really knows you. You can feel very alone. Then you come into a place where you're set apart from society, and in a way you're still alone. But God has done some amazing things to you. In 14 and a half years, you're not the same person you were when you came in here."
"No, not even near the same person."
"We hear so much about praising God in the midst of difficult circumstances. Has praise been a big part of what's allowed you to really exist in a free way spiritually in the midst of all of this chaos?"
"Oh, yes. To praise the Lord, because God inhabits the praises of his people. But to praise him, that's even a choice that we make, too. It can't be a feeling that we have. It has to be a choice that we make to open up our mouth and release that praise to him, so that through that he can come in and do in our lives what he needs to do."
"For every action, there's a reaction. Every choice that we make in life has a consequence."
"Yes."
"In the society that we live in today, there are a lot of adults making choices that are inappropriate. What would you say to them?"
"You have to think about others. Every choice we make affects somebody else's life. Every decision we make affects somebody else's life. And there are consequences, whether they're positive or whether they're negative. We have to get back to the basics of what God says in the family and everything, and we need to let our lives be governed by the morals of God, by the integrity of God. And until we do, it's almost an I don't care attitude." "Well, it is an I don't care attitude. It's I don't care about others. I just care about myself. Out there, before I knew the Lord, I always said I had to look out for number one, which was me, or nobody else would. But we know who number one is, don't we? We know that number one is Jesus, and number two is others, and then us. And if we can really live our lives that way, our world would be changed."
"You've had a date set now, as everyone knows, but You know, that really, I'm sure this hangs over your head the whole time after a sentence like this has been given, but it really comes home once there's a number put on it like that. Are you afraid of dying?
No, I'm not. I'm not afraid of dying. I mean, I know where I'm going. I know that Jesus has already gone to prepare a place for me. I know that if I have to go February 3rd, that he's going to come and he's going to escort me personally. I believe that. I have no fear of that, and I don't worry about myself, but I certainly am concerned for those who are going to be left behind, for my family and friends, my husband.
You know, we don't know what God's plan and purpose is in all of this, and, there are just a lot of us praying for you. And I think about everything that's been in the media lately. You know, I had to laugh the other day because we've looked at the gender issue, we've looked at politics, we've looked at the death penalty, we've looked just so much issues. And the other day I turned on a program and they were talking about advocacy journalism generated by
but what I think I saw that one.
And I just shook my head because I thought, you know, we don't get it. It's not about any of those things. And in truth, it's not even about you.
No, it's not.
It's all about him.
It is about God. It's about redemption. It's about the blood of Jesus and what the power of God to change a life. It is about what Jesus did on the cross.
And that'll be true whether you're commuted or whether you're executed.
In my life or in my death.
I know that
it's wonderful, but just what the Lord's doing in your life and how
God delivered me from death to life, bro.
Amen. Amen.
What he's been doing in my life right now is whenever I first accepted the Lord, for so many years, truly the joy of the Lord was my strength. And it was just like this fire that raged, the fire of joy that raged in me, like a feast at the banquet table, a feast of joy with the Lord. And for about 8 years, it was like this humongous feast of joy. And then all of a sudden, God put me in a situation where I had to grow up into, this is going to sound really weird, but grow up into tribulations. Mm-hmm. Does that sound kind of like taking me from my comfort zone and putting me in the lion's den and telling me it's time to go deeper, go deeper with me in other areas, because you can reach out to people with the joy of the Lord and let him touch them through that. But I don't even know how to explain it right now. Wow. Right now, there's a way that we can reach people through tribulations, that just like the ministry that you guys have, is there's inner healing and restoration. And until you've been through that yourself, you just can't minister that to others, you know, because the Lord said, comfort others wherewith ye have been comforted yourselves. Mm-hmm. And so until we've really been through I'm talking about the fire, until he's turned that fire up on us and caused us to go through it so that we could go to a deeper level with him. And that's what he has done in my life just recently with my stomach situation and being in my room for a while, and it was like I was in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. And I had shared with y'all, but I was by no means dry. I mean, it wasn't a dry place, because there's always a well of living water bubbling over no matter what, because circumstances don't dictate my joy. So the joy bubbles over no matter what. But had a really hard time with that situation. And the Lord had to say, I'm in there with you. What is it? Carla, I am right in there with you. And are people seeing you gripe and complain about this? Are they seeing you praise me and show them that my grace is sufficient right there in that? And it was another place where he took me out of my comfort zone. and said, there are people out there that are going through exactly what you're in right now. Until you go through it and you let me bring you through that, there is no way you can minister to them. And there was a time when I couldn't have. I'm ashamed to admit that there was a time when I would have said, get over it. You know the Lord. Yeah. Get over it.
Yeah.
But he showed me it's not that easy. And so he took me through something that I wouldn't have chosen for myself. And what I was sharing with you earlier is it's not about what we would choose for ourselves, but what God has chosen for us, and that we accept that with joy. Just like in that book, that we accept that with joy and surrender and yield to what he's doing. And then he'll start showing us where he's at work around us, just like in the experience of God. He'll start revealing where he's at work around us most of the time through what he just put us through. You know, what he just put us through. There's going to be somebody that he's going to say, okay, you just went through it. Now here's somebody. Now you go to them and you minister to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been pretty neat. Just like,
really changes your life. I mean, because you don't have to fear pain, because you know the Lord will be with you in your pain. And so instead of trying to dictate circumstances,
yes,
you put your trust fully in the Lord, and you welcome pain because you know that in the pain you're going to have a depth in your relationship with Jesus,
yes,
and with other people, because it's really,
yes,
I'd say in our ministry, the strength has been that he brought us through a lot of pain and sorrow, and he's never failed us. And so when we see others in those same kind of situations, like you just said,
mm-hmm,
you can just give them hope and say, he's going to see you through.
Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing, I had gotten to a point, I was at a point in my life where I believed that, I mean, we all absolutely know that God is well able to heal us, to do anything in our lives that he so chooses. Just with a blink of an eye, God is capable of doing anything, but he's not always going to do that, because it's not always what's good for us. And while I was in the room, and my husband and I were really praying for healing, for physical healing for me and everything, and it was like I just jumped right up on the throne and just demanded this from God. I'm your child. You're supposed to heal me, God. You know, I'm not supposed to be going through this humiliation and this tribulation. And I was telling him how to be God in my life. You know, your word promises me these things. They're mine because I'm in a covenant relationship with you. They're mine. You've got to do this. And when I finally shut up and could listen to him, He said, I will do what I know is best for you.
And I'm God.
I'm God. You let me be God in your life. And he showed me that the way that the world sees humiliation is not the way we should look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Because what he calls it in our lives is tribulation.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things that I went through, I thought, this is so humiliating. Well, I'm going to tell you that Jesus truly does heal you inside when you're going through something like that. If he doesn't bring the physical healing, which he is well capable of, but if he chooses not to do that, either right away or until you get home,
mm-hmm,
the inner healing comes when you truly release that to him. Put it at the foot of the cross and leave it there and tell him, you know, I just had gotten to that place where, you know what, God, I can't do it anymore. I'm at the end of my rope on this. I've prayed, I've begged, I've demanded, and I've got to let it go to you because it's starting to get the best of me. And he said, that's what I've been waiting on, Carla. You know, so, and then he started restoring to me the joy of my salvation again,
yeah,
and that peace,
mm-hmm,
because I was allowing the enemy to take that from me,
mm-hmm,
slowly. You know, so he was able to restore that when I released that to him completely and said, okay, God, you don't have to do anything. You are well able to do everything, but you don't have to do anything because you know what road you have to take me down to get me exactly where you want me.
You know, and in reference to me,
well, it tells me a story that he lives in you.
Carla, the story of Jacob where he wrestled with God,
And he wouldn't let go until God blessed him. Are you still wrestling with God about February the 3rd?
No. Oh, no. I've never wrestled with God about February 3rd. I've always put that in God's hands and have a great peace about it. I want those who are left behind if February 3rd happens, I want them to have peace with that too. Mm-hmm. And to know, I mean, even through the prayers, when we pray and we believe God is going to do it, if when he chooses to do it his way, and if that way is to call me home, we have to accept that. Mm-hmm. And we have to have peace with that. And we have to go on and minister that mm-hmm. to people also. Just like in Hebrews, in the faith chapter, where there were those whom God delivered, right. And there were those whom God didn't, that they died believing. So we have to use whatever he gives us.
Right.
As a way to minister to people. We have to accept that from the Lord.
Last night when we had your prayer vigil, I'd really prayed about what to share. And, you know, when you look at Esther and how they prayed and Esther was released, and that was, I mean, that's so exciting, and all the people, and it's a great victory
yes.
book. And right now I feel like this is a great drama, and the whole world's watching this unfold.
Yes.
And, you know, God has shown me that he is the producer, the director.
Amen.
You have the star role. You have the lead role.
Well, I don't know.
And we're all supporting cast. But it's basically, it's in God's hands.
Yes.
And with Esther, there was deliverance for the people.
Yes, for the people.
Right.
Wow.
But there are times when it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked about that last night in the main prison because it's so important. I said, I gave a word from you that you want us to glorify the Lord in this. As you think about February 3rd, mm-hmm. and we all are praying. We're praying that it's favor. We're praying for release.
Yes.
What is it that you'd like to say if you do choose to be with Jesus on February? You don't choose it, but it happens that you're with Jesus on February 3rd. What would you like to say to those of us that would be just grieving because we're going to miss you so much?
I want to say thank you for just, I love you first. I love you guys. Your prayers that you lifted up all the time that undergirded me through this as part of what God used to keep my joy level just skyrocketing. And it couldn't have been done without the prayers. It couldn't have been done without that kind of support. And I'm still going to be here in spirit with you. I'm still going to be here in the hearts. And I'm going to be up there seeing what's going on now. I'm going to be in that arena with all the rest of them, rooting you on while you're down here still going through it. You know, I'm going to be rooting you on and applauding when you make it and helping you when you kind of, you know, are going through hard times. So, I mean, we're still going to be together, and I'll see you again one day. There's just so much. There's more, but this.
Yeah, we can.
There's so much more. I mean, so many people have affected my life in so many ways. You know, I remember back in 92 when Kathy Ryan, she wrote to me, and I was just learning about the refiner's fire, and Kathy Ryan wrote to me, and she said, "Carla, I'm praying for you, and this is what I'm praying for you, and you may not like it, but I'm going to tell you what it is anyway." She said, "I'm praying that God will just stick you right in the middle of that fire and just turn it up and just really put it to you." And it was so neat because that's what I was going through at the time. God was putting me through the refiner's fire, and he was teaching me about that, and he was taking me deeper, and he was bringing all of this junk up, and he was showing me how to go through that. I don't know. It was wonderful, and Kathy Ryan was bold enough to step out and say, "This is what I'm praying for you. This is what you need in your life." And that's love, you know. That's loving a sister and not being scared to you know, share uncompromisingly what God has put on your heart with somebody. And Mary, oh gosh, Mary, her way of expressing herself, she is so free in the Spirit. And when she came in here that first time, and we did those little clay vessels, yes, it was so awesome. I mean, first she danced around in the Spirit, and she was doing like what, when God, as he, she was doing what she thought God would be doing as he was creating the world. And I just sat there in awe of how free in the Spirit she was. And then she shared about God the Creator, and that helped me to get a deep, deep revelation of the Creator. He is inside every one of us. You know, God, his creative nature is inside every one of us. And we can create just like he can. And it just came so alive to me. Every time Mary comes, just the way she expresses herself, and she helps us to take the clay and to take different things and to just shut our eyes and to let God create what's going on down inside of us, you know, what he's doing inside of us, to bring that out and create it with our hands and show it and share about it unashamedly, you know, and to see how us women shared about the pain, and the guys, yes, kind of held back, yes, on that one. That was so wonderful.
That really touched Dallas.
They skipped over the pain. Went right into the victory.
Boy, that's what we all want to do. It's just like, yes, we just want to move. But it really, it's the pain in our life.
Yes.
That brings us into a deeper place with the Lord. I know,
yes,
we talked about this in the other video we did. We talked about the fact that it's really the pain that presses us into him, and where we really get to know him.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul prayed that he could share in the fellowship of his sufferings.
Sufferings, yes.
And Carla, through what I've been going through recently with you, I have a new understanding of God the Father. Because I think of how God the Father knew the Son's execution date,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and how perfect that Son of God was, and how he loved his Son. And as I was thinking about that the other morning, I was walking, and I just said, I'm sorry, God. You know, I'm so sorry that you suffered that. And yet I know it was for us.
For us.
And I know I wouldn't be thinking that way if I wasn't where I am with you today. So I thank you for the honor of walking with you. And you'll never know, you know, till you get to eternity, the number of lives that you have touched in a little death row cell in Gatesville, Texas. I mean, it's just incredible.
In this last interview, her husband Dana Brown speaks.
People were looking after not just mine, but both of ours best, what they thought was our best interest, by saying, you know, you're not going to be able to touch, and you're not going to be able to love and squeeze one another, and you're not going to be able to be there all the time for one another. But God had put something so deep in our heart that it's just unmistakable.
Did you ever believe that there was a man like Dana and that he would choose to love you?
No, I never. In my wildest dreams could have imagined. I didn't even know how to pray for somebody that wonderful. Even knowing the Lord, I didn't know how to pray for someone that good. No, I never.
And I really just felt like, and I know that the Lord spoke to my heart, and he told me, if you'll walk through the circumstances, if you'll walk through the circumstances, I'll deliver Carly into your arms. And, I mean, I knew that the Lord had spoke to my heart, and we believe it, and we're standing on it.
Dana, this one's for you. I'm not going to make it through this. Gosh. I love you, Dana.
You've been my rock through all of this. And thank you for helping me know a part of God's love that I could have never known without you. And for being used by God to help me know that I could even love the way that I do. Through our marriage, I've discovered that I can love unconditionally in every way there is. And we're making it through this together. We're making it through this together. And if God calls me home on the third, I know you'll keep going strong. I don't have to tell you that, but you know you have a passion for people behind these fences, and God's given you a lot of people to help get you in here. And I know that I'll be with you when you come in here. Oh. It's been so awesome experiencing what we have together, and to find out that truly God's not boxed in. He's never been boxed in with us. And I want to thank you for not listening to man, but listening to God, for showing me what a man of God is all about, and for stepping up and being in my life all that God called you to be. We know that our heart's desire is to be together. And we also know that God's will is most important. And so as we make our request known to Him and we march on, we can be sure that there's a lot of people out there that are going to be reached for Him, that are going to be brought out of the kingdom of darkness because we chose to follow Him. We can help them choose the same thing. I love you, baby.
There are many, Dana, who will wonder how you could be here just hours after your wife's death and share it. What's keeping you going?
Jesus. It was just Jesus, Kathy. And the love that she had for Him was so inspirational and has touched so many lives. And as you look around here today, I mean, she's literally touched the world for Jesus and been a tremendous testimony. And to be honest with you, I don't think it's going to stop just because she went to be with Him. I think it's still going to reach out. Her testimony is going to reach out to millions of other people.
What was on her heart, that her last words? What did she say? And knowing her as well as you do, what do you think she hoped to impart?
She was just asking for forgiveness and trying to touch people's lives, even in with her last breath.
What was her countenance like when she died?
She was radiant, just glowing. The love of Jesus radiating through her and around her.
All right, you guys, that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening, and until next time, stay safe and take care.